Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. How's everybody doing? You okay? I'm a little sweaty. I'm a little, I don't know, man. Charlie Watts is dead. But it's weird. I love Charlie. I love the Rolling Stones. I listen to the Rolling Stones probably every week, at least once a week, on purpose. Not in passing, not as part of a playlist. I will listen to Rolling Stones records all the way through. I listened to Get Your Ya-Ya's Out over and over again a few months ago when I was hiking. I've been listening to Blue and Lonesome a lot. For some reason, I do listen to that Get Your Ya-Ya's Out because that is where I really first understood the power of Charlie. Oddly, it's on that live record. And oddly, it was on a reissue of that live record. There was a slight remix done. I don't even know if the Stones like those reissues, but I think the Abco reissues. And I remember I got it a few years back, and I used to listen to that album all the time, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out. Yeah, because it's a great live album. It's one of the best live albums because during those breaks, during Midnight Rambler, you heard about the Boston whank. And if you turn it up right there, you'll hear some guy go, God damn. And a woman go, just scream. And they do it through all the breaks. God damn. But I think what really struck me on the remix was just how fucking tight that rhythm section was. Just how fucking tight Bill and Charlie were. And realizing that without that, everything is a fucking disaster. Like Keith, as great as he is, famously one of the great rhythm guitar players. And I started thinking about that. And, look, man, I love Keith. I love Keith. I love them all. All right? I miss Bill. I wasn't going to go see the Stones a few years ago with Dino because I just didn't feel right seeing him without Bill. But Dean talked me into it, and it was great. Daryl's great. But the thing about the rhythm section and hearing Keith talk about Charlie, you know, and their sort of unspoken kind of understanding of each other performatively, is that Keith, without Charlie and Bill, would just be chaos. You know, it would sound, you know, disorganized, kind of like fragmented and stilted. That Keith Richards, his entire sense of rhythm that evolved over time is only because of Charlie Watts and finding those holes and finding that place to float on Charlie's jam. And Charlie fucking had to follow Keith. And you don't even notice that. And that's got to be a chore at different points in time. So without Charlie, you got nothing. You get no Stones. I mean, look, you know, obviously, if they decide to tour and Steve Jordan goes out with them, I mean, he's a great drummer. But I mean, throughout the whole thing, that there's no, really, Charlie is one of the most solid beats, keepers of time there is. And he can swing and stay on top of it at the same time. It's crazy how good he was. But if you really want to listen, you know, to the subtlety and the genius of that rhythm section, of Charlie and Bill specifically, give a listen to that Get Your Ya-Ya's Out. And listen close, because they're holding it together. Charlie's holding the whole fucking thing together. How do you think Ronnie and Keith can do all that messy fucking swap that they do without Charlie kind of like just being the bedrock? You know what I mean? Charlie was great. And just a real suave motherfucker too. Great drummer. Great Rolling Stone. 1 out of 5. Gone. Great. great charmer. God, I'm going to miss him. I mean, I still got him. I still got all those fucking records. I got all those records. Charlie never leaves. And he lived a good life. And he lived a long life, especially for a rock dude. Yeah. Rest in peace, Charlie Watts. Godspeed. Swing it. I forgot to tell you who's on the show because I wanted to honor Charlie. Today I'm going to talk to Kimmy Gatewood. She is one of my co-stars, or was one of my co-stars on GLOW. She played one half of the Stacey and Dawn duo with her real-life comedy partner, Rebecca Johnson. And actually, Kimmy and Rebecca were honestly very early comedy podcast adopters when they turned their Apple Sisters act, which was their bit, into one of the early scripted comedy podcasts. Kimmy's been directing a lot of television lately, and she just directed her first feature film, the Eliza Schlesinger movie Good on Paper, which is now on Netflix. And it was good to see her, to reminisce. We reminisced. Before I forget, on my tour, I've added some shows. First of all, Helium in St. Louis, September 16th, 17th, and 18th. You can get tickets for that. The Neptune in Seattle, September 22nd, is available. I might add a second show if that sells out. The Aladdin Theater in Portland is sold out, but I've added another show. That's on September 24th. I just want to give you a heads up. The Dynasty Typewriter Show, October 4th. I'm not sure if there's tickets for that. There might be. New York Comedy Festival is now on sale for everyone. That's November 13th at Town Hall. Get tickets for that. Okay? That's the update on that. Good deal. So I've been festering about this thing on my finger, primarily because here's the deal. You know, I've become somewhat resilient to trolling, but, you know, I am not that resilient to suggestions about certain things that are actually worse for me than trolling. Like, I was on my Instagram, on Instagram Live, and I've got this thing under my fingernail on my index finger. And someone on the Instagram Live said, you should get that check for melanoma. So that was actually some of the finest trolling that I've ever been victim to. Because it's not finding my weakness around insecurity or jealousy or any of that shit. And it's not really those kind of plain triggers of people with entertainers' egos that you can get all worked up. It was something more refined than that. And I don't think it was the intention of the person that said it to troll me. But it just, I was like, looked at my finger and I'm like, what is that? I mean, yeah, it looked like I'd banged my finger, but I wasn't sure if I banged my finger because I didn't remember banging my finger. So I started to look at it. And then I, of course, Googled just a touch, just a tad, fingernail melanoma. Melanoma under nail. Didn't quite look like what I got, but it, you know, enough for me to start festering. And then for me to start thinking about melanoma and about how long would it take? Did it spread? What is going on? How do you get it out of there? That was my biggest thing. So I started festering about how, if they have to get, even if it wasn't melanoma, what do you get? How do you got to get something out from under a finger? So because of my ability to spiral, especially with hypochondriacal panic, you know, I started to think like, well, I mean, if it hasn't spread, which it probably has, so I'm probably got cancer, which means like I got to start that fight. And I was just starting to enjoy my life. So that's probably going to happen. And do I really want to die that way? So I might want to start thinking, you know, sort of kind of frankly and honestly about, you know, ending my own life because I really don't want to just rot away of cancer by myself. I got to get my affairs in order. And what, okay, let's say it hasn't spread. So then do I just lose the finger? Do I lose the tip of the finger? Am I going to be incapacitated right when I started enjoying playing guitar and playing out and doing this stuff? Is now when I have to adjust to playing with partial finger, with just part of my index finger on my fret hand? Do I have to make that adjustment? Would I make that adjustment? I'm not a professional musician. Why would I make the commitment of trying to play with 3.5 fingers? No one's going to give a shit about that miracle. I'm a pretty limited player. And I'll just be the same limited player, only with a half a finger on my index finger. And maybe I'll get away with it. I don't know. And what is that going to look good cosmetically? Are they going to be able, am I going to have some weird kind of tiny nail sticking out of the top? Am I going to be ashamed of my hand? Oh, my God. So when am I going to the doctor? So I started to spin out. And then, you know, on the plane, I started pulling my cuticle back on the bottom so I could see how deep down the melanoma went and just, you know, how much damage you're going to have to do to the finger if they have to sort of cut off the top or scoop it out. And then I, you know, I kind of like, I fucked up my cuticle looking at that. And then I just went into full-on panic and I was like, well, I don't even know the doctor I'm going to really on Wednesday. Are they going to give a shit about me? You know, they're part of my plan. I've been there before, but I'm starting to think that some doctors, they just kind of blow through shit and they just kind of like, you're not, you know, they care to a certain degree, but I guess some of the lessons I learned when Lynn passed away is that these doctors can be pretty passive. They have nothing invested in you. If you don't have a relationship with them, you're just, you know, something that happens. You're just part of their day. Something that happens. They do their job. If you die, they don't know you if you don't have a relationship with them. So then I start freaking about the doctor I got to see. And then I'm telling Dean this, and he's like, I got a guy. I got a dermatologist. So I went to Dean's guy, who's kind of a whiz, knows his shit. And he looked at my finger and he said, oh yeah, that's not melanoma. I'm 99.9% sure that's not melanoma. It looks like you banged it or something. Let's get the microscope out. So we got it under the microscope. He's like, yeah. I mean, how long has it been there? I'm like, yeah, a few weeks. He's like, if you would have told me that's been there for a year, maybe I'd be concerned. If that was a melanoma that size, it would have had to have been there about a year. And it looks like you banged it, you bruised it. But why is the cuticle all inflamed? I'm like, oh, because I was pulling it down with my other fingers so I could see how deep the melanoma was. He's like, oh, well, I'm going to have to give you a prescription for some cream for that so it doesn't get infected. So in my panic, I might have injured myself. So what's new? What's new? Poking and prodding. Poking and prodding. But I also had some other realizations about mortality. I realized that whatever the case is, and thanks to my friend Dean, my friend Sam, my friend Kit, for talking me through somewhat of a spiral, that, you know, that I'm going to get something. If I don't die quickly, I'm probably going to die of something. And I'm 57 years old, and I got to sort of grow up around that. I certainly have a handle on the idea of mortality. I've certainly seen death up close now. But something's going to happen. And, you know, how you handle that is going to speak to who you are, your sense of character. And one of the things I realized when I was panicking and dragging other people into my panic around my non-melanoma under my nail and what that was implying to me in my head and how it triggered my fear was that I know people with real sickness. I know people living with real sickness. And they live with real sickness. And they do what they have to do to manage that sickness. And that's part of life. And for me to spin out as if anyone's going to make me feel better. I mean, when the shit really comes down, it's going to come down. This wasn't that time. And not panicking is probably the better way to do it. And I thought I'd sort of had a handle on that. Like I've been more of a hypochondriac in my life, but I just usually I think like, well, I'll wait a few days and see what happens. And that's usually what I do. But the nature of these type of bruises under the nail, they take months to go away. So that approach wasn't going to work. So I'm giving myself a pass on that. But just realize when you're freaking out about probably nothing that you should be handling as a grown-up, it's important to get things checked out and to realize you know, that you can and should do that when you have something you're concerned about. But try not to freak out prematurely because, you know, you're going to have to go call all those people that you freaked out and say, I'm all right. Thanks. Thanks for letting me drag you down the panic hole. So this is me talking to my friend, Kimmy Gatewood, who is the director of Good on Paper. It's a Eliza Schlesinger movie. She's also was in Glow with me and has directed a lot of other stuff. And there's some comedy of her out there. There's stuff. There's stuff. And this is me talking to Kimmy. This is the longest we've ever talked, her and I, actually.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
So, you're making jam.
Yeah. And this is pre-pandemic too, so.
The
jamming was pre-pandemic.
Oh, so you can say like, so you have to qualify it like that?
Yeah.
This was not done out of fear and sadness. This was done because of an abundance of figs.
Yeah. No, the bread my husband making was made out of fear and sadness.
He did the bread?
He did the whole bread. He's still doing it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
He's got
two different starters. One, the Bestia starter. He started that one.
Where'd he get that? From Bestia?
No, he started it. They have a recipe for it that you can follow.
I've never been there. You know, I just went to their other restaurant yesterday.
Bavel? Or
yeah.
Bavel?
Yeah. However you say it.
I don't know.
But
it's good.
Holy shit. Like, I never go to restaurants because I cook.
Yeah.
And I'm so disappointed at restaurants. So, because like, usually you're like, what is this? I could make this. Or it's not amazing. So fuck it.
Yeah.
But that place is amazing. Like, it's so nice to go to a place and you eat something like, I could never make this. This is like magic food.
And if you get their cookbook, they have like egg yolks that take like days to cure.
Bavel?
Bestia.
Oh,
the Bestia has a cookbook.
And that's Italian, right?
It's like Mediterranean, Italian.
Really?
Slash.
Is it amazing?
It's very amazing. I don't eat, like, they have a bone marrow dish. I don't eat meat, but I eat fish. So they have this octopus.
Dish?
A bone marrow dish.
Oh, that's rough, man.
Everyone is obsessed with it. It's like they scoop the bone marrow out and then there's a whole pasta thing.
There's pasta involved?
Yeah.
Because straight
back
up.
Back in.
Yeah. Just straight up, because it's like the straight up bone marrow thing where people just scoop it out of the bone.
Yeah.
Like, things don't bother me, but there's something about that. The consistency of it. Not great. But I like fish. Tell me about the fish.
It's an octopus. Like, it's been sitting around and soft and.
Yeah. I like how that's a selling point. This stuff is rotten. it's on the verge of going bad, and it's just how we like it. It's perfect.
It's pickled and oiled and
I love octopus. I love it.
Yeah,
but it's all over the place now. I don't know how that is. Like, I start to doubt it's not one of those things. Like, is this fresh? Of course not. It was frozen,
right.
And then we did the thing to it, and here you go. I don't know. I feel bad. I didn't watch the octopus show.
My octopus teacher.
No, how was I going to eat octopus after that? I just knew right away from the trailer. I'm like, if I watch this, no more octopus for me. I don't know if that's true.
She was my best friend and my teacher, and I watched her give birth, and I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah, no, but that Bestia dish is still good. It's like, you can't, I know. I won't watch this stuff. I should probably not eat meat. I don't know.
I became a vegan because this guy I was dating back in New York was vegan, but he was the kind of vegan that ate like all that fake meat. So like I was just like farting all the time.
Oh, nice. That's the
gorgeous.
True test of a relationship.
Yeah.
Did that make or break it, the farting?
You know, we were okay for a while. Oh, yeah. I moved into his apartment. It was nice.
And you're both just vegan farting?
Yeah.
Great. Well, you know, if you can overcome that hurdle, it's not nothing.
Yeah.
And you got to.
Yeah. And then we moved into another apartment in Williamsburg, and there was an empty place. It was a bakery, and then it became a bar, and that pretty much broke our relationship because it was just like open until 4 a.m. And
that was
like
noisy.
I had that crazy person fantasy where I would like drill holes in the basement
or on the floorboards,
pour water down.
Oh, is that bad?
Yeah.
Nightmare. I thought, well, that's better than like, well, it's only 4, so we're both drinking. roll out of bed in the morning.
You guys open yet?
Yeah. We're just upstairs. Knock on the ceiling when you're ready to serve. Yeah. So were you living back in New York?
Yeah. So I went to Syracuse University, graduated in 2000, and came to New York right after
But you
after
don't live
that.
Here?
I live in L.A.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I moved to L.A. in 2008.
So Where does it all start? Where'd you grow up?
In Maryland.
Maryland?
Yeah.
Like, where's that? Like what part? I don't talk to many people from Maryland.
So I'm between, like, Baltimore and D.C.
Right. Is it Virginia's close to Maryland, right?
It is, yeah. Okay. There's something called the Delmarva Peninsula, which is Delaware, Maryland, Virginia.
Right, right.
And then there's
Delaware is one of the states where you're like, did we go through it?
Yeah. My favorite bit always is that Wayne's World bit where he's like, Delaware, we're in Delaware. I love it so much.
I don't know if the Delaware River Gap.
Sure.
Big bridge, right?
Yeah, and there's
pretty.
There's the Chesapeake Bay.
Oh, that's Delaware too?
No, that's Maryland. Oh. But
so how far into Maryland are you? Is that an east-west situation?
Well, you know, Maryland is a very oddly shaped state.
Yeah.
There's like the little cranky little thin part,
yeah,
the upper
right yeah, like, yeah,
and then there's,
oh, yeah,
the part that kind of hooks over in the Chesapeake Bay kind,
oh,
of,
yeah,
is in the middle of, uh-huh, it. So I'm, like I said, between Washington D.C. and Baltimore. So
right,
my dad grew up in Washington D.C., one of 13 children, so
what
I have lots of aunts and uncles.
13,
yeah,
that's,
yeah,
crazy from, yeah, one woman.
Yes, from, they were Catholic, as you can imagine, yeah, but Opus Dei Catholic, which is like,
wait,
the Da Vinci Code crazies type. I mean, I don't know if they like
what your dad was that.
My dad was. I mean, his parents were. But
so Opus Dei's been around that long.
Yeah, it's been around for a while.
Oh my God!
But my dad had me. He had a kid when he was like 17 or 18.
Because he
and
had
then,
to.
Yeah, you get out.
You no, there's no going back.
And then he had me when he was like 20. So he. I have
Same
a half
woman?
Brother. No, I have a half brother, and then I have two other siblings. But my mom.
So the half brother was like, "Oops."
I didn't even find out about him until I was like 13, and then he was in our life for about 4 years, and then we didn't hear from him after that.
Still,
yeah, I looked for him on Facebook. I found him once, and then I lost him again.
Did you reach out?
I think I was too afraid to reach out when
it's
I was
weird,
looking.
Right? Well, what was the story there? It was like some how did that happen with you?
I think it was
they weren't
was
married
in high
anything?
School.
Oh,
no,
oh,
yeah,
it was one of those.
Yeah,
right.
And then she decided to keep the baby, and then I really need to like get it dig in with my dad about that because
really?
I didn't really ask because it happened. Like I said, when I was 13,
yeah.
And then I was
that's
like,
when you found out.
Yeah, and then I was off in college.
I don't know what we need to find out and what we don't. I don't know.
I don't know either.
It just seems that, like, you know, because you, with fairly little effort, the information is out there now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and people find out things when they do genetic testing. A lot of people are finding out that they have half brothers. You know, that they've got to be like, Mom, you know, what is that? Accident. Yeah. It was a mistake.
We thought we took care of it, but now you untook care of it.
Exactly. We put it up for adoption. Now I don't even know the kid. Yeah.
The part that creeps me out the most, I think, is like the sperm donor, egg donor of it all, because like
these
the
doctors.
Whole, yeah. Well, yeah. Oh my God.
It's crazy. I'll just use mine.
No.
Yeah, I'm gonna have an army of people.
Oh, so creepy. Why do they talk like that too?
I don't know.
It's mine.
Yeah, like I've got plenty. I can generate this stuff every day. What are they? Who's going to be the wiser? They didn't know about 23andMe.
No.
All they knew is in their hearts that there were 20 kids somewhere.
Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm.
To know that?
I know. It's wild.
It's messed up. And then, like, what if they get married?
Yeah.
What if they just, what if
oh,
they
the
meet?
Two kids?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't think of that.
Brain instantly goes to that. One of 13, you're like, I have so many cousins, I have to make sure they're not a Gatewood.
Exactly. You got to do a genetic screening just to date a person in the area. So, D.C.,
yeah.
Opus Dei, were government? No? In government?
No, my sister works for the government now.
But your dad's family, the large Catholic family?
No, they did like my fascinating story. My grandmother grew up in Las Vegas. She was a part of, like, her dad was the owner or the president of the Nevada Bank. So they were like socialites in Las Vegas
from
for a
the
long
beginning?
Time. Yeah, like, yeah. He was like...
In the heyday.
Yeah, indeed in the heyday.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like, there's so many stories about my grandmother. There's like that my great-grandfather got the job because he had nice handwriting.
Yeah.
He worked his way up to be president of Nevada Bank. And then the other story, she's like, I lived across the street from Bugsy, and I'm like, really, Grandma?
Yeah. So did everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's like Barbara Streisand's mom in Brooklyn or wherever that is.
Yeah.
We lived right across from Barbara's mother.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's Queens. Maybe it's Flushing or something. Everybody's like down the street from Barry Manilow. The Jew thing is, you know, Barbara Streisand's parents, Barry Manilow's parents.
People. He lives all over New York.
But Bugsy's cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's cool. And then she met my grandfather, who was a life insurance salesman, and then had 13 children.
Wow.
Just like the heyday of Las Vegas quietly disappeared from our family.
What, 13, do you know all?
Yeah, I know all of them. That's they all crazy. Came to my wedding.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That is insane.
I love them. It is so cool to be a part of a family that big.
And so how many cousins? 90?
It's probably at this point.
Right?
I mean, because the cousins have cousins of cousins, you know, and like, it's a lot. Like the last I checked, I think it was 47.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Now,
it's a lot.
I'm sort of fascinated with the Opus Dei thing, but it sounds like you're a generation removed from it.
I am. I don't know too much about it.
Yeah.
And my dad wasn't really into it. I mean, I was raised Catholic just because that's like what had to happen. Like my parents were like banished from being married. They had to elope.
Oh, they did? Why? Until she became
religion. Yeah, she became Catholic and then.
Is it hard to become Catholic? Latin involved? Rituals? Robes, smoking orbs.
Just like a lot of kneeling and standing and kneeling and standing.
Yeah. Eating the crackers.
Yeah. Because my mom's mom was Baptist, so that's what my mom was. So.
Oh, that's a lot more, that's a modern, more exciting religion.
Yeah. It was pretty fun. Like they had, so in the Catholic Church, we had wine.
Drony music. And the Baptist church was more lively.
Lively, but they had grape juice. Oh, so that was less fun.
Right, yeah.
Because you, when you're a kid, stuff? You got a little sip of wine.
Yeah, no, we did that. The Jews did that, after services, little Mogan David.
Yeah.
That's where it starts for a lot of Jewish junkies.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah.
Strung out Jew blues players. Well, is that bar mitzvah wine?
Man, my favorite Jewish holiday is definitely Passover, but only like one day of Passover.
Are you married to a Jew or something?
No, but I dated a lot of Jews and also like be with friends being a comedy, but like loved going to Passover.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Purim show they used to do with Rob Kuttner at the Y in New York? I used to do that one all the time with Seth Herzog.
Oh, Seth Herzog.
Yeah. I did that show once, I think, or twice, and I went right after Zach Galifianakis, and I was like, why am I here? Why am I doing this? I am not supposed to go after Zach Galifianakis.
Did he kill?
Yes. And then I came up there like, and Kimmy Gatewood. I was like, listen, I was not long for stand-up.
I know that feeling. But wait, so when you went to, like, you have two siblings?
I have two siblings, yeah. Yeah, one works at UPS. He's a driver.
Oh,
and
really?
Then the other one works at the ATF, so.
At the, which is?
The artillery tobacco firearm.
Oh, right. No, it's
ATF.
Alcohol,
yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. Is he an agent?
She's not an agent. She's she works. She doesn't really. I was like, what's going on? Tell me everything. She's like, I don't.
What are you working on?
Yeah, I know.
When's the raid?
I know. I'm like, I got to write a movie about you. She's like, I work in administration, Kimmy. Book their hotels.
That sounds exciting. So you just at the computer most of the time, then you get some water sometimes.
Yeah. I give a presentation every now and again. Really?
Wow. Like what? How many people? In uniform?
Yeah.
Normal siblings.
Out
in the world.
Yeah, my mom works, like she works at a company that does the monitors, like the train tracks, like the engineers' train tracks.
Riveting.
I know. Indeed, riveting.
Is it air traffic control for trains? Kind of?
No, it's like testing the tracks to make sure that they're safe.
Is that a job you go to work for every day?
My mom basically just like gathers, she's the same thing, administration, gathers the receipts and does the travel for all the people, the engineers that go out on the trains.
Okay. So she's like, we got a problem on mile 20 of the, is that the kind of thing?
No, she's more like, your flight's at 3:55, don't miss it. Don't forget to give your expenses and receipts.
Right.
And,
okay.
And then the guys come back.
When did you start doing funny shit? Like high school or?
I was introduced to improv in high school and I would just do it for intermission. I would do an improv show in the high school.
At the assemblies?
No, at the plays. So, and the intermission of the plays. So I'd be in the play and then I'd come out in the middle of intermission and be like, all right, guys, go and buy, you know, drinks or whatever. Yeah. And I'm going to put on an improv show.
Really? Yes. So you were in the theater group at in high school?
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm going to carve out this niche for myself.
Yes.
I'm going to riff while people are going to the bathroom.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Love an interactive yeah. moment. You know?
Hey, come back here. What, is it just you?
It was a lot of times just me, but then I would train people to do it with me. So we would do bits like with, I had a couple of people that would do it with me.
Yeah.
Some people wanted to stay in character.
Yeah, right.
Take
right.
their moment during intermission.
Oh, and you I was mean like, the people in the play?
Go.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I was awesome in the play. But
you
I
were
also like
come
to...
on, you guys, to stay in character. You guys
come on, we got an audience here. Yeah, they're
yeah.
captive.
Yeah, yeah. You're 14. You're not a method actor. Let's just do this. That's funny.
Yeah, I mean, being a part of big family, I would always put on a show and stuff, and I think that comedy was just a way of like the love communication and
yeah.
the family
sure.
and like making each other laugh was yeah. like when you were beloved by the family.
Oh, yeah.
Funny.
Right,
you know?
Right. Memorable.
Yeah.
We know this child out of the 40 that we have. This one seems to have some talent.
I was huge in the Gatewood Circuit.
Yeah.
Killed him. Killed him with the Aunt Lottie jokes.
Yeah, they loved it back in the day.
But I came to New York and like you're so much a part of my story. It's hilarious.
I
to
am.
Me. Yes, because like I did
after college or did you
yeah
go to college?
After college.
Where'd you
I
go to college?
Syracuse.
Oh, so you were way up there.
Yeah.
Did you
yeah.
do theater there?
Yeah, I did. I was either going to go do theater at Syracuse or biology at Maryland, and I said if I get into theater school, I'm going to go to theater school.
Really? That was the crossroads.
Yeah.
Like a life of research.
Yes.
Or maybe being a doctor, right?
Yeah, exactly. And well, then, that was the thing. My friend, her brother or sister was work is a biologist,
yeah.
and she's like, I research chicken shit all day, and I was like, huh? Oh,
wow.
This is I don't know if that sounds nearly as exciting and romantic as I thought it did. You know?
Yeah, 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 yeah. No, it definitely doesn't. But it's another one of those things you could do a movie on. To go on with the
So what do you do all day?
Tell me, where do you get the chicken shit? Are the chickens on site? Because I think we got an act two there. We won't even see the chickens.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Believe me. I'm like, I'm asking my brother all the time. I'm like, what's it like being a UPS truck driver? Maybe I could make a character on this.
Yeah. Sorry, it's already been done. King of Queen, or what is it? Yeah, King of Queen.
King of Queens, yeah.
Been done. He's full UPS driver, wasn't he?
God, I didn't even realize that.
Yes,
he just
yes.
like, came in a.
Oh, see, you would have done a whole script.
I know.
And be like, been... Didn't Kevin James do this for a decade? Oh, damn it.
Thanks, Mark. You saved a year of my life.
Saved you some time. So you do theater, like major in it kind of deal?
Yeah, I majored in theater, in acting.
Wow.
And then, but it's funny, again, like, never got in like the main stage shows or anything, would audition. And then I found, again, I would go to do improv shows, the late night improv shows.
Mm-hmm.
We had this like comedy troupe, the Broken Compass Players
It's so funny, the college improv group.
I know.
What their names are. I just talked to Tom McCarthy,
uh-huh.
and he was in one at BC, a long running, you know, sketch troupe.
What is that, Running with Scissors or something?
I remember what his was called, but they actually moved as a group to Minnesota.
Holy cow.
To sort of like do it.
Wow.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people, a lot of good people from Minnesota. Colton Dunn, Charlie Sanders, Victor Varnado, all those guys are from
Minnesota, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, that was the generation after me. We were the rogues, the stand-ups.
Yes, yes.
Out there on our own.
Yeah. Room to room.
Exactly.
Performing for moms everywhere. Yeah.
You younger kids with the group work. You social animals.
Team players,
yeah. Fuck that, man. I'm a rebel. I'm out there on my own being sad in hotel rooms.
No. What the life? It's terrible.
I've actually grown to really enjoy that part of the life where I'm just in a hotel room. I'm like, I don't have to clean this. There's nobody. I don't hear any noise. I don't have to worry about anything. Really. It's perfect.
There's a tiny water wherever I go.
Yeah. And it's just peaceful. It used to be sort of like, where am I? What kind of life is this? And now I'm like, It's nice.
Can read a
it's
book.
Quiet. Yeah, can write. Yeah, there's nothing to do. All right, so you're doing heavy. You're doing sketch, but you're also doing what?
Improv and
Beckett yeah. Yes. And are you doing the heavy?
That's
play?
True. I took a whole semester on Beckett.
You did?
Yeah, loved
Come
it.
On.
Yeah, I really did.
Can you explain what is the key to Beckett? What's the essence?
So okay. My approach, like I took this Beckett class and I thought it was so stupid and I hated it. And I was like,
really?
It's pointless. And I was like, this is garbage.
That's sounds like exactly what Beckett's trying to get across. Sounds like you got the message.
I was like, it's not like he's trying. And then like, I just got put into context. And that's like, I feel like when I understood suddenly like reactions and art and what everything.
Context.
Yes,
very important.
Context.
Yes.
And like my little, one of my nieces said like, history is stupid because you don't like use it today. And I was like, no, no, girl, no. Like
right.
History is everything. Well, you have to know the context for where reactions come from.
That's a big fear. Like that's my fear of like the way the internet is shifting the brains of younger people is that mm-hmm. there's no context and seemingly no need for it. So
yeah.
We kind of float in this time-free zone and we just react to everything all the time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
In real time rather than looking back
yeah,
at
no,
like what...
You
what,
have to contextualize to understand the importance of anything or else everything gets dismissed and just thrown onto the pile.
Right, exactly. Like you could look at a... Like some people look at a protest as like, you're like, look at those angry people on the street just messing up my nice lawn. And it's
right.
Like, no, no. Let's look at the context and why they're protesting.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Like the history no. of, you know.
Sure.
So it's... But I think that really opened my eyes, and I'm glad that I took that class.
Just that it gave you that intellectual piece where you're like, I don't get this shit, it's stupid. And then you're like, but this is what was happening in theater and in the world and where he was at the time. And you're
yeah.
like, oh.
Totally. It was a breakdown.
It was a reaction.
Yes, totally. It was, right. It was like a breakdown of like, what is the meaning of theater? And like, you know, and I became absolutely obsessed with it. There's this one called That Time that I staged. It just like completely, they're all somewhat insane. I played an Endgame. I played the old woman.
Uh-huh.
There's like Ham and I forget them. I'm going to get roasted by my theater friends.
Okay,
but
well, you can take the hit. You had it coming.
Yeah, I did. You know, you're right. Lizzie Kaplan.
Yeah, Lizzie.
It was her. She's talking.
Yeah.
She's talking right now.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that out of nowhere I pulled Beckett out and it's actually the thing. Did it start to frame comedy for you? Like, I mean, like it must have had some influence on something
Yeah, I think... I mean, I studied Hitchcock for a semester, but Beckett really stuck with me a lot.
Yeah.
I think it was just like thinking outside of the box was something that kind of stuck with me.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And not like, I love mainstream comedy. Don't
yeah.
get me wrong. It's my favorite.
I saw the movie.
But, yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. I'm just constantly trying to get my mother to watch something. She doesn't have Netflix. She's never seen Glow. She's never.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I'm like,
that's the worst.
Right, I'm going to keep. Listen, my biggest accomplishment was a Peyton Manning commercial I did.
Ugh. I hate when they do that because they. Well, you know, everything's changed so much. So they don't know how to sort of like contextualize your fame.
Totally.
Because it's like, is it on an NBC? No.
No.
ABC? No. CBS? No. Then what is it? Right?
Sam Beckett. That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's a deconstruction of network television. Nothing.
Yeah. Nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
It's the worst.
But yeah. I think a theater school. I feel like studying both mainstream and kind of the greats. You know. Was just good for me to, like, it expanded my palate because I had kind of, you know, mostly done just comedy in high school. And there's only so much that a high school,
sure.
you realize a high school teacher can really handle,
yeah.
you know, and
right,
like what
right.
is appropriate.
And what, yeah, and so, what a kid can handle.
Yeah. So it was good to just really kind of challenge myself. But during that whole process, it was like, I was also doing marching band. I played the trombone. I was at a ska band. And I mean, it was prime time.
Wow. Marching band.
Yeah.
Did you do that in high school too?
Uh huh. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And in
so
comedy,
you were
you're like, oof.
A band nerd and a theater nerd?
Yeah. It's a lot. You can imagine.
But you're a very expressive nerd.
Huh?
A very expressive nerd. You're putting yourself out there in a lot of the ways that, you know, mainstream people are like, what the fuck? Look at the chick with the trombone. Dude. She's also in that play, man. Yeah. What play? That plays here?
Yeah. She also did the intermission. Yeah, improv show.
Don't you remember intermission? Dude, so fucked up. I don't remember anything. Did we even stay for the second part of the play? Yeah. High school.
She did a whole bit trying to sell a flower to me. She said it wasn't a banana. It wasn't a banana, bro.
Yeah, so she's all right, man. She's cool. So, but you're doing the sketch stuff, so you're learning how to work with people. And then you just go to New York?
Oh, yeah. After college, I went to New York. Just went straight to New York. Moved in with a friend from college. Mm. Worked at Columbia University for a year as an assistant to a professor.
Yeah?
It was a weird job.
What kind of professor? How'd that
comparative go? Literature.
Really?
And
my buddy's a teacher at Columbia.
Yeah. I got that job through, it was a temp job, and this woman, Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak, who's a very impressive professor, she went through like 50 assistants in 6 months. Like, nobody liked to work for her. And I was like doing extra work on SNL and stuff.
You were?
During the time, yeah. And like, I wanted to audition and I wanted to be in theater. And then I got this temp job and she was yelling at me for whatever reason. And I was just like, why are you being so mean to me? And she went, you know what, Kim, I like you. You talk back to me. You keep me in, you talk straight to me. I would like to offer you a full-time job. And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, here you be a punching bag.
Yeah. So I said yes, because it was like, you know, $35,000 a year or whatever. And like,
did she keep yelling at you?
She kept yelling at me, but I would just talk back. I would just clap back and like.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, there's the movie.
Okay, UPS truck driver meets a professor from Columbia.
Exactly. Yeah, and the ATF.
Yeah, exactly.
Is on to them.
Yeah, but it was wild. It was a really interesting job because I would. I just like didn't care what she thought because I had no interest.
Nothing invested.
Yeah,
there was
nothing
no future
invested.
To it.
Yeah, but that's what she loved about me, I guess.
Did you learn anything from her? Could you go to classes or anything? Or was she an interesting person?
I read some books. She really liked Kurt Vonnegut, so I read a bunch of Kurt Vonnegut books.
Good.
And finally read Bluebeard. Mm. And I was helping coordinate this guy Dada. I don't know if you're familiar with like Dadaism or whatever, but like he's like he came over and I kind of learned and I've already forgotten about Dadaism.
There was a guy named Dada.
Yeah, there was.
I know what Dada is, but I didn't know there was a Dada.
There's a guy. Yeah, a guy Dada.
Yeah, Dada Daddy.
Yeah,
yeah, a Dada Daddy.
But I learned at the time. I don't remember now, but
yeah.
I definitely loved all the philosophical like. Thought I don't know.
Yes, high-minded shit.
Yeah, it's so fun. It's just like it all goes back to like, you know, Beckett opening your mind and stuff. So, I'm like, this is so fucking stupid, and I'm like, you know what? They have a point.
And academia is its own world.
Yeah,
I mean that's where that stuff lives.
Yeah,
it's the only place that keeps it alive, really.
Mm-hmm.
Any of that stuff. If it wasn't for academia, no one would give a fuck about Beckett anywhere.
Totally.
It's sort of sad. Every once in a while, they can sort of convince two celebrities to do Waiting for Godot.
Yeah.
And then people are like, no, it's the thing.
Bill Irwin, he saved us again.
But maybe I'm being cynical. I don't
know.
But
also, you know, it's...
So how did you get extra work at SNL?
Oh, man. So, you're not going to believe this. A cousin.
One of the many. One of the 90 cousins.
My cousin's aunt.
Yeah.
Who's a screenwriter out here. He's genius.
Your cousin is.
Yeah, Brian. And his aunt, so not my aunt, but his aunt, mm-hmm. so his mom's sister,
mm-hmm.
she worked for Lorne Michaels. And I got in to do extra work.
You were just on the list.
Yeah. They were like, can you, my friend, my cousin, you know.
Yeah. Sure.
So I got on the list. And then I did it the amount of times you could do it before you had to join a union. And then at the time it was AFTRA. So it was like $1,000 to join and I couldn't afford it. So I did it until that moment. But like it was just wild because it was my dream. It was my whole dream was being on Saturday Night Live. Yeah. And I did.
And this is before you did comedy or anything else?
No, this was like at the beginning. This was like the year 2000. Right when I landed, I was doing this and I couldn't believe that
so
I was so close.
There in the studio on the set doing the thing, sitting at a table.
Yeah, like sitting in the, there was those like screening room type places that they would just keep us and like.
Who was the cast then?
It was like Horatio Sands, Chris Parnell.
Uh-huh. What about Will Ferrell? Was he gone or is he?
I think he and like Shira Terry, Molly Shannon probably left.
And what about Fallon? Was Fallon?
Yeah, he was still there.
He was still there. Yeah,
but I didn't really get to meet too many people.
But you get to watch him, right?
Yeah, I got to watch him and UCB like Horatio Sands would hang out and so he would come back and say hi. Yeah.
So right when you got here, you got into classes over there?
Yeah.
So that's it. Was that when it was in the old porno theater?
Yeah, on 22nd Street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I started I think the theater started in 96 or 98 maybe. 98, yeah. They were at Solo Arts. And then in 2000 when I got there, they moved to 22nd Street.
And Matt Walsh lived upstairs.
Did he live upstairs?
Kind of, or right
oh
there.
Oh my God. I worked at a place called Live Bait on 23rd Street, and he would come in there because he was dating one of the girls there.
I remember Live Bait.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was it was a happening bar for a minute, right?
Yeah.
It was right at 23rd in that area by the Flatiron Building, kind of, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I couldn't get a job at the sister place. It was the diner in Union Square. Do you remember that place with all the hot models worked
there?
Oh,
yeah. What was that called?
I forget.
It's a big place.
Yeah. And there was all models that worked there, and I applied to work there after Columbia.
Yeah.
And they literally looked me up and down. And went, "You should go Live Bait."
Oh wow!
It was so rude.
Wow!
You can only imagine though, being a marching band and a theater nerd.
Yes.
This was something a rejection I was used to.
Go to Live Bait. Take your trombone.
Yeah. But I learned how to shuck oysters there at Live Bait.
All right, so you got the job at Live Bait. But so you're doing the SNL thing. You're doing the UCB. Mm-hmm. Who's teaching at UCB?
It was Andy Secunda, Sean Conroy, Billy Merritt.
Oh, yeah.
Amy was still doing, one-off classes, and Ian Roberts was still doing, an occasional class here or there.
No Matt Walsh?
He was probably teaching, too. I didn't
know Besser?
I was so afraid of Matt Besser. I'll never get over my fear of him.
Yeah, he's intense. there's something, I can see how it'd be frightening.
Right, it's like a 22-year-old, you're like, oh God, I don't want to fuck up in front of you. And I would do those late night shows where all right, Kimmy, get on stage, And I'd be like, oh God, I'm going to fuck it up.
Yeah.
And then,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Besser?
Yeah. There was these shows where you would just kind of throw everybody on stage, shake them off stage. And it was a thrill, but it was so scary.
I don't know that whole process. You're just hanging.
Improv.
I go do shows, stand-up shows at UCB, and I'd have this fundamental resentment against these, well-adjusted people that can work as a group, and the audiences. No matter how many people try to hang alt comedy on me or me being part of it, I resented it. I was at Luna yelling because I couldn't get work elsewhere,
I was there. I was watching you.
Yeah. Is that where I made a difference somehow? Is that how I'm part of the story? But that was in the
90s. You were there.
Later.
Todd Barry, Slovin and Allen, all those guys.
Yep.
I would do I finally did a 30 for 30 or was 60 and 60, those. I was when I did that, I was just I've made it. And
as a stand up?
Yeah, just doing a bit. I don't know if I was a stand up.
Was it a minute bit?
Yeah.
I remember those.
Yeah, those were fun.
What was the point of those? What was the name of the guy that used to organize those? He had kind of a good name. I can't remember. He was a comic. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name. We can't do the memory
no.
thing. No. But you were trying stand-up?
Yeah, I did stand-up for a minute. And it's just because I was trying to figure out where I belonged in the comedy world.
Right.
Because it's like coming to Hollywood. You're like, I'm going to be an actor. And then they're like, this is really crazy. Try something else.
You can't just do that.
No.
Yeah.
So I tried it. My friend, a college friend, worked for Barry Katz, so he would put me on a couple of gigs.
Yeah,
and I went out with
That's a messy hole of a office to work in.
Indeed, I opened for Bobby Kelly once and Al Madrigal.
Sure.
I was like, I would. This was not my crowd.
Well,
I did guitar comedy.
You did?
Yes.
Bobby Kelly, those are sweet guys.
They're so...
Those two.
Yes, they're so sweet and they were so funny and we had a great time.
Oh, good. Out of all of the comics, you got two that... Yeah, I mean, Bobby Kelly's a monster, but he's a sweet monster. Very sweet monster.
No, they were really nice to me, and yeah. But it's just like they could tell like that I was a funny person, but I just like it was not translating to me on stage,
right?
For me, for stand up,
yeah.
So I just was like, I don't think I need to do this anymore. But improv was like connecting with me, and sketch was really like connecting with me.
When did you meet Rebecca?
I met her in 2006.
So you were just bouncing around for years in New York?
Yeah. Wow. I taught improv. I worked at the Pit.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, the Pit. I remember that place.
Yeah. And People's Improv Theater. I did work with Kirsten Ames, who...
At Westbeth?
Yeah, I worked at Westbeth.
Or not a 45. After. Well, so
after, like, Itty Izzard times. Like,
oh, okay, yeah, and, yeah, you did. When, so I did Jerusalem Syndrome around that time.
I know. I know, Mark.
That was like 2000 and what?
That was... So Kirsten Ames...
99.
She took me under her wing and, like, she was doing a solo show class. So she needed directors.
Oh, really?
For her solo show class. So... and it was an amazing class of people, like including Ophira Eisenberg was in this like class, Lisa Lampanelli was in the class, and so it was just after your show, so it was kind of like a template for like how a solo show could be developed.
That's right. And, she definitely developed mine with me.
Mm-hmm. So, like, so I would work with people's stories, their real stories, help them develop into shows, or like if they wanted to do a character.
Dramaturging.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then I would, you know, then start to put together their actual solo shows.
Who'd you do that for?
Eileen Kelly.
Uh-huh.
Nagin Farsad. There's a couple others.
That was sort of a format.
Yeah.
That was sort of a way to present oneself at the time.
Indeed. I mean, listen, I had two solo shows still.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, I just talked to a guy in Denver who's about to do one at the Fringe, you know, and it's like, as a form, you know, I don't know. I you know, I look back on the what I've done and how I've done it, and I don't know. Do you know what I mean? You know, I'm still a comic.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea of the show, the solo show, gave you a little more latitude. To, you know, when you're a comic in your heart and soul, there's some part of you going like, no, you can't be funny all the way through. You know, I can't. Yeah, wait, Mr. Drama Guy now? What are you? Got funny. You're going to cry a little bit? What are you going to do?
Having a Tom Hanks moment, sir?
Exactly. Like, you know, there was a, like, you know, it was something like, you know, you can't manage, you can't handle the, you know.
Yeah, I hear you.
But I did them. And Jerusalem Syndrome was like, I look back on it and it's such a mockable format. Which
Andy Secunda did a one woman show because he had directed so many. It was hilarious.
Oh,
he
really?
Did his own one woman show.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Classic. Yeah, it was very fun.
Armisen used to do a bit about a guy doing a one man show. He would just do it.
Yes.
Have you seen that thing?
Yes.
After I saw that, I'm like, oh my God. I can't. No one can do him anymore. Just the movement, the weird intentional stage movements of a guy who's not used to being on stage in any way and had to really make decisions. It's fucking genius. So that's what started you directing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I directed in college. I did Black Box.
The Beckett.
Indeed. Yeah. I did Beckett stuff. I did the female version of The Odd Couple in college.
Oh,
which
that's
is
a fun show.
I love that show.
Yeah.
And what really motivated me was that my professor at the time said, well, why would they do it with women? That how is that funny? And I was just like,
God.
It was like, the fire was lit. It really, really pissed me off.
Just
and it
that.
Was, yeah.
Isn't it weird what teachers can teach you involuntarily?
Yes, indeed, sir. And, yeah, so I had kind of been, I mean, how I got to where I am today is kind of like, I've been doing it for a long time, but didn't necessarily know that it was a thing that you could do, because everyone told me it was too hard to break in.
To direct a film.
Direct a film, direct but, TV, anything like
but
that.
But it seems
which
like-
it is hard. It's hard.
Sure, but I mean, but it seems like, I think you and Rebecca were sort of ahead of the curve in the podcasting.
Oh yeah, we did our Apple Sisters podcast. And,
now yeah, so because that's sort of, it seems to me that in terms of landing in the comedy world in an earnest way, it was with that, right?
let's see. I mean, so when we created the Apple Sisters in 2006 or 2007, and we went to the Montreal Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, and that was like kind of our big break. And that was in 2008.
And this was just the two of you, right?
Three of us.
Three of you.
So me, and Rebecca, like, and Sarah.
A nostalgia act in a way.
Yeah, we're a 1940s comedy radio show. So yeah, like, I love the Marx Brothers, came up with that. Like,
yeah.
And we love to sing and dance. Sarah's comes from a Broadway family. Her grandmother's Ruby Keeler from 42nd Street.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And Rebecca and I were the only female teachers. And people kept telling us, like, at the Pit. And they're like, you guys should do a show. We're like, fuck you, just because we're women. And then we're like, actually, I think you're really funny. You know? I did this, like, pinup calendar, a comedy pinup calendar.
Uh-huh.
And Rebecca saw it and was, all right, we're going to work together forever. And I was like, great. Super.
Yeah.
So we came up with this bit. And we did a new show every month. So we would write three brand new songs, choreograph them, write comedy bits, like your classic pie in the face. Like,
so it was almost, you know, like a period piece variety show.
Yeah, but it was satirical. So we would very much talk about a lot of, like, the war going on because, you know, Bush was president at the time.
Okay.
And like, as like,
as our, these characters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'd be like, there's a war going on, sir.
Yeah.
A woman running for president. You know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, right. Yeah, yeah. It's great. Yeah.
Get back to the kitchen.
Yeah.
But there's three of us. There's Candy, Cora, and CD Apple. I play Cora Apple, the dumb one. I just love semen. sailors. Candy is she's got a husband named Cheryl who's a man fighting in the war overseas.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And our closeted lesbian character.
Yeah.
And then CD Apple, who's like the Jesus loving, in denial conservative of our group.
Uh-huh.
So we've had a lot of fun over the years, like just poking fun at politics through the 1940s lens.
So when you did Montreal,
yeah.
I mean, what did that yield? I mean, were you offered a show, or did you take meetings as a group? And
No,
you did.
We got agents and managers from that.
Oh yeah, so that was it. Huh?
Yeah, we signed with like UTA and Prince Pato Young after that. Like,
because
we were like the only unrepresented group. We were the only females in the sketch comedy like block.
Are you still with Prince Pato?
No, not anymore. But
you still with UTA?
No, not. Things change, Mark.
You got to start somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
it's so funny because I knew Peter Principato when they were all starting out.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that, you know, it's just the nature of the thing. Everybody starts out in whatever they're doing in show business, and they just eventually evolve, and some make it, some don't. I was such a dick to him and those guys. I was just like, you know, who the fuck are these people with these suits? You know, like, I just couldn't. It was relentless. I remember there was a point where Peter, like, you know, made the shift from, you know, being a suit guy manager to the leather jacket guy. And I'm like, he's a leather jacket guy now. But then they went on to have, you know, big career. Like, they're big, you know.
Yeah.
But when I knew him, they were like, oh, who's this guy? You know, I was such a dick. I got to be careful of that stuff.
I think it's all right, Mark. Mm. You're doing all right. People love you for exactly who you are.
I bet you he remembers me as a dick. There are some people that have those memories.
You know, yeah.
Peter Principato is probably one of them. I don't think he has a lot of power to hurt me now, but remember that thing you said about my jacket?
So, I'll never forgive him.
Yeah, never forgive him. You're not working for
I wore flannel for the rest of my life. Yeah.
No Principato projects for that kid. But so that's where you got the agent, you got going.
Yeah, and that's the year I tested for Saturday Night Live because I was doing my solo show called The Engagement. And so I was doing like, I was doing a couple of weird impressions, like characters, impressions, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite impression was Judy Garland, who was afraid of bears.
Oh, really?
So stupid.
But that's the kind of thing that they do.
Yeah, it was really fun.
How'd it go?
I was, hello, I'm Judy Garland. And you're a bear. I'm sure you're a bear sitting in front of your microphone and laughing with your big mustache. It's a bear mustache if I ever saw one. So stupid.
Did you get all the way through to Lorne?
I did. I got all the way through. Got the call to do like the comic strip. Had to go show up in the middle of a show.
The Marcy Klein call? Was it?
And they they were like, all right, like, I remember going to that show, like, one girl's throwing up in the bathroom.
Mikhail
Watkins was actually
throwing up?
No. Oh. No, but we auditioned together, Mikhaila and I.
Yeah, I love Mikhaila. Yeah.
And that's when I, like, first met her. We were on the audition, and I was, like, obsessed with her when I saw her bits.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard thing to come up on
stage. It's a sad story, her SNL story.
I yeah, it's kind of crazy. Like, our paths were like right. They were like, and then she went up there, and I like ran to LA.
So she got on the show for what? Was she always only on 1 year, right?
Or, yeah.
And then you went where?
I went to LA. Like, it broke me. It broke my heart.
The rejection of it?
Yeah. Because I went, you know, I did that and then got, you know, you went tape, to the studio. And then you go studio, and then you test at 8H. And like, I was getting very encouraging, you know, emails and texts from the writers there. Yeah. But then I didn't get it. And it just like broke. It broke me. I was broken.
Yeah. I was like, heartbroken. Business.
Yeah. And I literally was like, I'm leaving New York. There's nothing left for me here.
And what about Rebecca?
We all decided to go to LA together.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. We came to LA together. Thank God.
Where's that movie?
Listen, all right, we got
a lot
five.
Of movies.
I know. This is just a movie pitching session.
The Columbia professor is still my favorite.
Okay, good.
Only if she has that accent.
You got it. Yeah. She's from colonialized India, so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very specific. How is that not the best movie? So you get out here.
Yeah.
And everything, the sky's open. LA welcomes you.
I'm working at the City Bakery in Brentwood. My boss is 18 years old. And I'm almost 30.
Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It was a rocky start, but I was determined to make it, Mark.
Yeah, and look at you. You did it.
Yeah, but Rebecca came and Sarah actually went to Las Vegas to do Jersey Boys. So we were performing between LA. We were doing our live shows in LA and Las Vegas.
Did you do Jersey Boys?
I was in the movie. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the movie, right.
Sarah was actually pregnant. And so she said to the casting director, my sisters, which,
right,
you know, at this point, we're basically sisters, but like, my sisters can do the show because they've seen it so many times. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got it, which was wild.
Jersey Boys is the Rudy Valley one?
The Which Frankie one? Valley?
Frankie Valley, yeah.
Yeah.
Frankie
Who's Valley. Rudy Valley?
Rudy is an older actor.
Oh.
From probably the 40s-ish.
From the 1900s?
Yes. So let's see. Discography, 1929 was
I
his
love
first
it.
Record. All the way through to 1976.
I mean, they were contemporaries, I guess.
Kind of.
Sort of.
He's an old-timer.
Yeah.
But Frankie Valley, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I met Frankie Valley. Took a picture
you
of
met
Frankie
him?
Valley. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was wild. I met Clint Eastwood. That was crazy. Well, I mean, he directed the movie.
He
so.
Did?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How was Clint?
I mean, he's like the coolest guy ever. Mm. And I mean, this was like shortly after the chair situation. So that was a little weird.
Yeah. Politics aren't great, yeah. but show business. Yeah.
Showbiz, indeed. Yes. He let me improvise on set, which was.
That's
crazy.
Rare for him, I think, isn't it? I don't. Does he do that?
I don't know. I don't know.
Did it make the film?
No. But he liked it.
Okay.
But that movie just stuck basically to the Broadway show script. So.
Right.
So
you just let you improvise to entertain him.
Indeed. But you do like two takes. We you know, you don't do that much. It's a very quiet set. He's very just like efficient.
Mm.
Just gives you like one little adjustment, but really like trusts the actors.
Yeah.
When you're talking to him, he's like, I don't like to look at myself anymore, Kimmy.
Really? He said that?
Yeah. He's like, when I look at myself, I see this old guy, but I don't feel old. You know?
It's kind of heartbreaking somehow.
Yeah. But then he also made jokes about, you know, my improv being like rated G, rated PG, and then rated X.
That's fun. It sounds like you had a real dynamic, a real relationship, right?
Yeah, he was, listen, I mean, he's an actor, so you imagine that he just knows. The cool thing about him is he knows and, like, will come to you because he's a legend. Like, cause I'm sure it's very intimidating to go to somebody like Clint Eastwood, where some people will close themselves off.
Right.
It's intimidating to approach them. He's not like that.
He wasn't like that. That's nice. So when did you start that Apple Sisters podcast? That was with Earwolf, right?
Yeah, it was Earwolf. I think we started in 2010.
Sort
maybe?
Of a radio play kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we would take our old live shows, our scripted shows, and we would write new podcasts about them. So we would do...
Because that was like you must have been one of the first ones doing radio theater podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was the Thrilling Adventure Hour. They were doing stuff, I think, in tandem, but in LA. So we didn't really... We eventually crossed paths, but... But yeah, we were doing like, I didn't realize how kind of, not revolutionary, forgive me, because radio has been around, but like how different it was to be doing scripted stuff on podcasts at the time.
Yeah, because it was the Wild West then. I mean, that we started in 2009, and there were podcasts around, but it wasn't a popular medium. So you could kind of do whatever you wanted. And there was only a couple that I knew of doing that scripted stuff.
Yeah.
The you know, straight up radio plays in a way, some of them. And that became a very popular mode later. I don't know when that happened, when it really started to take off.
Yeah. Like, why we didn't continue is because like there was like some, I don't know, some structure stuff. But then like we didn't make any money doing that.
Sure.
We didn't. And they were paying their engineers, but like I don't think that much. And like then when they were like, you guys have to figure this out on your own, we're like, we have no idea how to get listeners
and to figure make a living to make money.
Once we had done it for like a year doing all these brand new scripted shows, we were kind of like, what are we doing, we're just kind of like we had a really great listenership, you know.
Yeah.
And then it just, it got, it, once they kind of handed it over to us, we were like,
It's hard. How do you fucking do it? How do you get traction? How do you do, what do you do? What, it handed over to you in which sense? In order to like, try to monetize it?
No, I don't, they were just going to take away, they were like, we can't do your studio time anymore. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it was like the infrastructure they were taking away from the podcast.
Well, that, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
Then you're going to do it at your house, that kind of thing? So they kicked you out of the building.
Yeah, kind of. But I think that was when like some, you know, like when they're probably being bought by somebody.
By Scripps.
Scripps, yeah. But yeah, we were, that was, it was fun for us because you didn't have to do props, costumes, book a stage, you know, but then there was, but all of the recording and, you know, tags
producing.
And producing was all being done for us.
Oh, in order for you to keep doing it, you would have had to figure out, find somebody to do that.
Yeah.
So it just went away.
It just went away. That's right. It was kind of sad.
And then you were just doing the acting.
Yeah. Back to acting, Mark.
Yeah. And then you get Glow.
Yep. I get Glow. The thing that definitely completely changed my life because I was about to actually go run a podcast network.
Seriously.
Yes.
And they wanted you and Rebecca as a package.
For Glow, yes. Yeah. So we auditioned together. So Jen Houston, the casting director.
Yeah. Legendary casting director.
Legendary.
Yes.
So we met in New York. She saw the Apple Sisters, was a fan of the Apple Sisters. Mm-hmm. You know, brought me in for like Scott Pilgrim. Like brought me in.
Yeah.
Was very, very supportive.
She's great. Another one I've known since she was like a child, I think.
Yeah. She's amazing. She's, you know, buds with Allison Jones. Like they kind of are and like, those two really have changed my life for sure.
Yeah. Another casting director.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Jen brought Rebecca and I in, and we just thought we didn't have a chance. We were like, Jenji Cohen show.
Yeah.
Like a Glow, which we both knew and liked.
Yeah.
And we were like, this is never going to happen. And so I was going to get, like the timeline is kind of crazy because I was going to get on a plane. I was going to do the audition, get on a plane in New York, accept the job, and then become a executive producer of a podcast network.
Yeah.
And so we get the audition. She's like, you can improvise, just do some characters and stuff. So we did like the Apple Sisters.
Yeah.
We did a couple of other bits that we'd kind of come up with. Because like we drove back and forth to Vegas for years, Rebecca and I. We have so many show ideas. We have so many characters that we do.
Why back and forth to Vegas so much?
Because Sarah Lowe, my third Apple Sister, lives in Vegas. So Rebecca and I would drive to Las Vegas. So during those like hours and hours and hours on the road, the two of us, we came up with, like, we had a business together called the Nerds of a Feather where we saw feather fascinators.
Uh-huh.
We worked at the same bar together.
Uh-huh.
We sold a pilot together. Like, we have done so much shit because of that car ride.
Yeah.
That when this came along, it was just like an extension of just like us being in the car for 5 hours.
That's great. Yeah. Like, that's great.
So
that's a great story. The incubator.
Yeah, indeed. And so we auditioned and then we got a call back and I was like, hilarious universe. So I had to move my plane for my interview a week. I was like, let me
for
just
the podcast network, the big podcast break. what network is that? How are they doing now?
It's Earwolf.
It is.
They were great. Full circle.
That's interesting.
I like the people that work there. Yeah. Now. So we did the callback, which they didn't give us a script. It was Liz, Carly, Genji. They're just like, come up with some characters. So we were like, okay. So we just came up with some wrestling characters. Mm-hmm. We did some old ladies, mm-hmm. and even though they didn't ask for it, but then they just sat and talked to us about our story, and like we had how we met, and like we had children 3 months apart, and like we've just done everything together. And they wanted real friends who were also a comic duo,
right?
And that,
like, it was custom made for you guys,
truly. But we just really didn't think. And we saw Sidel coming down from like, right. We were like, she's so fit. I was like, we don't have a chance. Like, like I was like, I had a baby like 9 months ago. Like, this is not a good look. So we were like, fuck it. You know, this is kind of one of those auditions that we really threw caution to the wind. And then I went to have coffee the next day with Molly Prather, and I decided to turn my phone off because I was like, I'm going to be in the moment. I haven't seen you in so long. We were roommates together.
Yeah.
She goes to the bathroom. I decide to turn my phone back on, and there's like 40 missed calls. That was the day that we got GLOW.
Oh, wow. That's great. It's nice when it's all at once. Yes. Yeah. You're like, what?
Yeah. It was a life-changing experience for sure.
It was a great time we had.
Man. It was a great time we had.
And it's so fucked up that we couldn't finish it.
Yeah. I really liked your message about the movie. I really liked it.
I don't remember what I said.
You were just talking on social media, on us live stream. You're just like, just let us do the fucking movie, man. That's what the people want.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't have been that big a deal.
No, it wouldn't have been that big a deal.
They, you know, they could have, like Netflix could have done it. You know, I don't know what budgetary like things, but it was already, they already written the fucking season, most of it.
Mm-hmm.
So like the writing wouldn't have been that big a deal. And you know, in terms of like, it just seemed like it could have been done. It would have been a nice thing to do.
It would have been really nice.
But it really was an issue of, it's not that I have sympathy, but I understand why they couldn't do it. They were just holding on to all those location sets, and it was indefinable. And we could barely do it now. I mean, the protocols just shifted with that kind of show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was no way to do it without daily testing, and it just wasn't there, and they couldn't wait.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
That was sad. That was a tough call to get in, like, the midst of all this shit, you know?
Oh, yeah. So what? How did you get this Eliza thing? How? Because this is, like, the first feature film.
Yeah. So I started directing television. Like, I got my DGA. I started directing before, like, I directed a couple YouTube Red series. I directed of like sketches, and I did all of Rachel Bloom's like music videos. And
you did,
and like,
so you've been really busy with it.
Before GLOW came along, I was just doing these, like, I did a web series called Junketeers for Comedy Central, and I did a YouTube Red show called Hyperlinked, and I'd done those pilots, and they both got picked up for series, and it was kind of one of those things that motivated me that this might be what I should be doing instead. And then, of course, GLOW was like, nope.
They wouldn't let you direct.
No. They just
oh, they casted you, so you're back in it.
So I'm back in acting again. However,
you're back to the puppet show.
Yeah. Though I didn't believe it. Like, I just didn't believe that, like, anything. I didn't trust acting. Like, I don't trust acting gigs. Like, they always feel so fleeting. And
you don't have any power. No agency.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes. Even though, like, it was the greatest, acting experience of my life. But I was just like, I don't know what's going to happen after this. I need some, like, insurances. And so, actually, I got my first DGA gig during the first season one of GLOW. So, they let me off an episode to direct this Amazon show, which was amazing because they didn't have to do that, but it was very nice. But they saved the salary, so that's good all around.
Yeah.
But then after directing a bunch of television, I directed, my first feature was a documentary called Nerdcore Rising that I did in 2008.
And,
I made it, with Nagin Farsad. We followed this guy, MC Frontalot, who raps about Dungeons and Dragons and Magic the Gathering. You know, it's very funny. So we were discovering this world in like 2005, 2006.
Yeah.
And we raised our own money. It was pre-Kickstarter, so we were just like asking people to PayPal us money, and we would put them in the credits. Always on the forefront, Mark.
Yeah, good. Cutting edge.
And that went to South by Southwest in 2008. So that's kind of like where I started.
Put you on the map.
Put me on the map in terms of like, I didn't go to film school, but this is kind of like my, I learned how to operate a camera. I learned how to do sound and I'd always been tinkering. I wanted to get back to a feature. So when this came along that it was actually getting made, which, you know, is a miracle that any movie gets made.
Eliza's
movie.
Yeah.
And she had been trying to make it for a long time. I read it. I liked it. I knew what to do with it.
Right.
It was with Universal. And it got pushed by 3 months. It was going to shoot in Chicago. Then it got pushed by 3 months. And it was shot in L.A.
Okay. It was good. She had good on paper for a long time.
Yeah.
Eliza had the script.
Yeah, she had the script for a long time. Because it was based on the story that she told in stand-up.
Yeah.
And so she, you know,
dating a guy that turned out to be a complete fraud.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I had to pitch, you know, to her and the producers and Universal, and I got the job. So
you had to pitch your vision for how you do it. Did you have to make a board?
The first meeting was just all talking about story characters, how it's going to look.
Yeah.
And then the second meeting, I put together a little lookbook for them.
Okay, lookbook, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
And had casting ideas. And so, you know, a lot of the references were, you know, those old thrillers and
Eliza trusted you from the get-go.
We had a great working relationship, and I mean, I would have notes and I would send them to her, and then she would turn around the script in like 3 days while she was on the road doing stand-up.
She's like a fucking worker, man.
Yeah, such a hard worker. And you know, it came together so fast, because I think I was hired probably a month before they were going to start shooting, and then it got pushed. So we got some time to develop the script and like get shit together. But luckily I had worked on a lot of independent, I come, you know, from independent film, a lot of indie stuff. So I could call upon a lot of good people, including my AD, Drew Langer, who worked with the Duplass brothers. So he really gets that low budget, fast paced.
Oh, yeah. There are people that Lynn could make a movie in a couple weeks.
Yes. Drew is actually Lynn's AD.
Yeah.
And
right.
That's why I obviously hugely admired everything she did and probably modeled my whole career after what she did.
Yeah. When she wanted to make a movie, she'd make a movie.
I know. It's so crazy. Inspiring.
Yeah.
Like, just do it. Like, what are you waiting for? Because we know that if you go through the studio, it'll take forever.
Yeah.
So this movie felt very much in that spirit. It was just like, let's do it. And,
you
know, called in every favor possible.
And it was popular, right? I mean,
listen, it was like this $1.2 million movie at Universal.
Yeah.
It got, we finished it right at the top of the pandemic. So I finished editing in February 2020.
Yeah.
And then had to do all the rest of the post stuff when the pandemic was first starting.
Yeah.
So we were just like let's try this thing called Zoom.
Right. Yeah, sure.
And try to do ADR.
But they didn't put it didn't get released until a few months ago, right?
Yeah, a few months ago.
Yeah.
So when we started this film, we kind of thought it was going to be, you know, this, South by Southwest in some theaters, and then Netflix kind of came in. They really got behind it and put it on billboards in Times Square. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's like
it might not have gone that way.
Yeah.
If you had gone festivals.
Yeah. It probably just
you'd have
been
to find a distributor and they made a big deal of it because does she have a deal there or they've given her a lot of opportunities.
I think.
So
she's
they
had a
like
sketch
her.
Show. Right. She had like 5 specials.
Yeah.
It was the perfect place to go ultimately because it would have ended up at a streamer anyway. And so the fact that,
I think when I saw her, she's like number 3 on Netflix. Right? Something like that.
That was trippy. And I was scared out of my mind because this, you know, I kind of went in thinking like, okay, great. This will be like, you know, like all my friends are like, they do the festivals and then they slowly get to their big movie. Mm-hmm. And like, it was just like out of the gate. Like, you're like, you're a director now. You do features.
Yeah.
This is what we think of you.
Wow.
It was scary.
Yeah. Is it still scary?
It is still scary.
Have you gotten offers and stuff? Are you?
Yeah. It's been great.
Oh, good.
It's been great. And, it's still always going to be hard to make a movie no matter what.
Yeah.
I had been attached to a big Sony feature before I got Eliza's movie, and it fell through. But that attachment to that big movie is the thing that got me Eliza's movie.
Right.
So everything like serves its purpose, obviously, and like everything's a learning lesson. And the Glow helped my directing career. The movies helped my TV directing career.
You
never know.
But it's working out.
It's working out.
All right. Well, it's good to see you.
Thanks, Mark. This is such a nice thing for you to invite me. I always wondered when it was going to happen, if it was ever going to happen.
It happened.
And it means so much.
Oh, thank you.
And my father-in-law listens to this podcast religiously, so what's up, Jay?
Well, okay. Well, good. I'm glad. It was great. I love talking to you.
I have to say, he called, he says, "Kimmy, Mark talked about your movie today." So thank you for that too.
But now he's going to know a lot about you.
I know.
Kimmy Gatewood, Good on Paper, the movie with Eliza Schlesinger that she directed, is now streaming on Netflix. Here's some sad guitar for Charlie Watts. Monkey, La Fonda, Cat Angels Everywhere.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.